You're listening to Community Radio, CKMS Radio Waterloo, 102.7, 946 on the Rogers Digital Network.
Good morning, Waterloo Region. It's Monday, the 13th of January. We have another show for you. Social justice show today, Katharina Lindman in from Rise for Climate. But this is The Respectables. The Power of Rock and Roll by The Respectables, a rock and roll band originating from Quebec City in Canada. They've been together for 28 years and have traveled across Canada on many tours. While performing in some parts of the world, Australia, France, England, Belgium, Switzerland, Cuba, Mexico, and the US, they have been mostly concentrating their efforts in Eastern Canada in recent years. On January 8, 2003, The Respectables hit the mark when they were handpicked by the Rolling Stones to open up for their Montreal show, part of the Stones Licks World Tour. They've won numerous prizes and awards in their home country, as well as selling more than 200,000 albums in the span of their career. The Power of Rock and Roll is a new album from The Respectables, produced by The Stones' own Bernard Fowler, and Bernard is also featured on the title track. Strong record, great classic songwriting, and genuine and authentically rocking studio performances. Hope to have them in the studio someday, too. I do have in the studio Katharina Lindman. Good morning.
Good morning.
I asked you to come in because everywhere I go, I see you. You've been at the various climate rallies that we've had, the strikes for school
Yes, the Fridays for Future Strikes. Fridays for Future, yes.
That's what I'm thinking of, thank you. I've seen you at DeVest Waterloo. I've seen you at various consultations at City Hall. What brings you to doing all this?
Well, I'm really concerned about climate change. I think it's one of the, you know, big issues. And if you took a look at the big picture, it appears that the world has really, like, failed to act in many ways. We've been talking about this problem for 3 decades now. And while we are seeing some signs of hope, it doesn't really seem to be coming fast enough. And we are now at the point where we really need to galvanize action and come together. So it's a great opportunity for us to change the way we do things. And a lot of people could say, well, you know, some of the ways we do things aren't that great. So there is an opportunity to weave more justice, less income inequality into solutions for climate change.
What sort of things need changing? Say we need to change things. What needs to be changed?
Well, it might be a cliche to say everything, but in a way we do. Our economy is based on fossil fuels, so we need to think about that long and hard. How do we change that so that we still have meet our needs without trashing the planet at the same time? One of the areas that I'm quite interested in is the potential for improving our health by whole food plant-based lifestyles. I don't want to call it a diet. It's not like something you do for a few months and then stop.
How does that relate to the other issue of climate change?
Oh, it's really big because our animal-based agriculture is one of the ways that we feed ourselves, and yet it's very wasteful. It uses up a lot of land. So the Oxford Food Study, for example, found that animal agriculture uses up 83% of the land, but only provides 18% of our calories. So if we were all to go plant-based, we could actually free up 79% of our agricultural land and pasture land. And if that reverted back to nature, I mean, we wouldn't have a biodiversity crisis. We could store a lot more carbon by growing trees on that land or whatever the natural vegetation would support.
And there'd be enough that there wouldn't be food shortages in
exactly.
places of the world.
Yes. Yeah. So we aren't feeding ourselves in an efficient way when we use industrialized animal agriculture. And there's a lot of pollution problems with it, too. Like, we don't handle the manure waste very well.
And specifically for climate, it's a fossil fuel-based system of agriculture, isn't it?
Yes, because the chemical fertilizers come from fossil fuels. So we also have to go to organic agriculture, and there's a movement to do agroecology, so a way that stores carbon in the soil, maybe towards more permanent crops, for example, or using practices that, you know, avoid chemical fertilizers or minimize their use. Like, those are just obvious things we should be doing.
And then I get my lettuce from California, my oranges from Spain, my cucumbers from China.
Yes, so there's all the global emissions associated with a non-local food system. So ideally, we'd have a local food system, an organic food system, and a plant-based food system. And we can take steps towards that. And the more we do that, the better.
So if we each take individual steps, then that would pretty much solve the problem, wouldn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, people don't take individual steps unless there's a culture around that's moving with them. So there is always that tension between, is it all on the individual or is it on our political system? Is it a combination of both? We have to, I think, push the levers on all those.
I would say it's on the political system. You know, a friend of mine, Vince Fiorita, who was a candidate in Burlington, said that climate emergency, the climate crisis, is a political problem, he said. And if you're not part of the political solution, you're part of the climate problem.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I think we can't ignore the politics because government does a lot to set up the system the way it is.
Yeah.
So, for example, right now, Canada subsidizes fossil fuels.
Yes.
So that is kind of saying, okay, this is important to us and we want to spend government money on it. But why don't we either stop subsidizing fossil fuels, because we know that, you know, depending on the estimate, about 80% of those fossil fuel reserves must stay in the ground if we're going to meet that 2 degrees Celsius mark. And we want to be aiming for 1.5 degrees so that we don't send those small island states to their death because, well, the death of the small island states.
And yet economic forecasts indicate that fossil fuel production is just on an increase and continuing to increase, and there's a rosy future for investing in that industry.
Right, and you don't know, well, how much of that is wishful thinking on the part of oil companies who have had a successful, profitable model and just want to kind of keep going on that. And, you know, will it really happen? So there is pushback. For example, Native communities are on the front lines fighting those pipelines. For example, the Wet'suwet'en recently have a blockade in British Columbia to stop the GasLink pipeline
And
on their unceded territory.
And that's not being recognized because the federal government is stepping in there.
Yes. So again, there's that political dimension to it.
Right. It's, you said we have to change the culture. And I think that may be what Rise for Climate and Rise for Climate Watered Region is doing. They're making it acceptable to talk about the climate crisis. They're making it acceptable to take action in that regard.
Yes, that's our aim. So we have had events where we invite the public in. For example, we've done mural painting in Waterloo Square. Let's get together, paint this big mural. We've done that. We've had worked with groups that are hosting climate parties where a group of people come together, you know, maybe 8 to 20 people come together and talk about climate change. And that's really important because we don't want this culture of silence around climate change. We want to engage with the issue. Yes, it's big. Yes, it's daunting. But we need to talk about it.
Talking won't do it, though. We need to take action as well. And taking individual action is tough because I still have a gasoline-powered car. Can't for the life of me afford an electric vehicle at this point. Transit isn't adequate where I live. I'm up in the rural area of Elmira, so bus service is not full day. You know, if I don't get home by 7 o'clock, I don't get home at all if I'm taking the bus. So it makes it difficult for people to take action, and a lot of the action that they take probably isn't very effective in making a significant, a profound change. For example, even if I do get an electric vehicle, that doesn't stop the government from providing gas subsidies to the oil companies.
Yes, yeah, all these things are true. So yeah, there's that tension between taking an individual action and saying, well, we need a lot more of it. So you could say, well, society is simply individuals multiplied. And we do need, though we do need the governments doing the right thing and showing leadership and making it easier for people to make those choices, almost to make it the default choice. Yeah. So right now the default choice is buy a gasoline-powered car.
And so when I talk about buying a car, the exception should be buying the gasoline-powered car and the normalcy should be buying the electric vehicle.
Correct. Yeah. And Tesla's making big strides with their electric cars, and they're also at the same time building the supercharging infrastructure.
Yes.
Whereas I think the big three automakers are sort of dabbling a little bit in electrics and not really thinking about the supercharging.
Or North American,
the charging stations.
North American automobile manufacturers are way behind the curve, but there are Toyotas, there are Kias, there are Hyundais that do have electric vehicles. But then again, the government has just canceled the green energy subsidy for electric vehicles. So, you know, it just makes it that much. This is the provincial government. The federal government still has a rebate of some kind. But it just makes it more difficult for people to make that happen.
Right. So the government needs to be more focused on how can we make it easier for people to reduce their emissions.
Yeah.
And as
we've just come out of an election, all the promises were made. Are we seeing any action?
A little bit. I think there are some. I am encouraged by sort of the Federation of Canadian Municipalities getting money from the federal government to do some innovative pilot projects, and that's good. One pilot project I know of, for example, is started by the KW Business Improvement Association in downtown Kitchener, and they are collecting, the working center is hiring workers to collect green bin waste, or what otherwise would be green bin waste, from businesses, because the green bin program doesn't cover apartments or businesses. It's just for residential use. And yet a lot of food waste would come from apartments, people living in apartments, and also businesses. So this program then takes that organic waste, brings it to BioN in Elmira, which is a firm in Elmira that makes these anaerobic digesters So then the organic waste is turned into both energy and fertilizer, an organic fertilizer right. that's really good for growing food.
Right. Is there a lot of demand for the fertilizer product?
Yes.
There is. Okay.
Yeah.
My understanding is from the anaerobic digestion is that a lot of the energy is pulled out of the organic material to form the methane gas, which then gets run through a generator to produce electricity, creating carbon dioxide emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the energy, a lot of the nutritive value of the remnants are already consumed.
Yeah, that's not what I got from reading their website.
Okay. Not from their website. No,
yeah,
I wouldn't think so.
Yeah, true. Yeah, and they showed a picture of, here's the field, you know, uh-huh. and half of it was sprayed with the the fertilizer, and it looked great.
Well, of course, they're running a business themselves.
You know? Yeah.
And yes, I admit that for an aerobic digester system like that, it is carbon neutral, because it's any emissions that it creates have come from the green stock that have absorbed the emissions fairly recently, as corn stalks were being grown or other waste materials being grown. So that's absolutely carbon neutral. But they're still shipping it there with diesel trucks.
True. Yeah. So that's all part of the...
Did a calculation a few years ago where they have a catchment area that pretty much covers all of North America. So they could be shipping material from Texas in a diesel truck all the way up to Elmira to generate some kilowatts of energy. Calculated that the energy used up by the trucks exceeds the amount of energy produced after a certain radius. So it would be more effective for them to burn the diesel fuel at the place where they're collecting the waste, because that would actually be a more effective use of the energy than shipping it all the way up here.
Yeah, so you have to be careful of is it truly economical or not, for sure, yeah.
And that takes a lot of knowledge. I happen to know a lot about this because I live in Elmira, and I was actually involved in the process of appealing the decision to locate the plant in the core of residential Elmira. I didn't want it there. We wanted it somewhere, as a group of us that tried to have it moved. We're unsuccessful. So I'm quite familiar with the operation there. And that took a lot of studying. You know, that took a few months of reading their material, reading other material, to find out that it may not be as rosy as they paint on their website.
Mm-hmm.
And is the average person expected to do that? You know, if we're talking to people at climate rallies and encouraging them to be green, they see a website that says, we're a green website and we're a green organization. Buy our product because it's good for the environment. Are we expecting the average citizen to do that level of research to find out whether or not that is really true or not, or whether it's merely greenwashing?
Probably not, right? Because we can't, we don't all have the time. Even with climate change, I think, some people are saying, I want to do something, what do I do?
Yeah.
I think good actions are to move towards a plant-based diet. I do think that's effective because of the resource use of the industrialized animal agriculture.
Exactly.
If you can, drive less.
Yes.
Consolidate your trips, whatever. You know, do some more biking. Also, if you can, buy an electric car the next time you buy one.
Yeah.
But the economics have to work for it, that it has to become affordable.
I've heard there's really only four things that individuals can effectively do to reduce their carbon footprints. And at the very top of the list there is drive less, or drive with an electric vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is fly less. And yet I still see some of my green friends jetting across the globe for vacation. It doesn't seem to have penetrated the consciousness of people. The culture isn't there.
Yes, yeah. After I read the book, Heat, I think it was called, by George Monbiot, and he talked about flying and how just sort of hopeless it is. It's very intense. And I do understand sometimes people have family, and I did kind of really cut back on my flying, but I did go, we did do a family vacation to Italy 5 years ago, less often for sure.
Yeah.
But I can see how sometimes with family it's
And there has to be a threshold, a significant number of people that stop flying, because a plane is still going to go fly with only one person less on board. There has to be at least a plane full of people that decide they don't want to go flying anymore before you actually reduce aircraft emissions.
Interesting, so that's part of that. Yeah. Tension.
So the other two things that I heard of that are effective to do at the individual level, slightly more contentious issues, is assume a plant-based diet. That's the animal agriculture and the transportation of food can be vastly reduced by buying local.
Yep.
You know, I can buy a potato from Elmira just as easily as I can buy a potato from China. Yet the carbon footprint for the one potato is much less than the other. So
mm-hmm.
if I buy local, that reduces the footprint as well. And then the most controversial thing that I heard was have fewer children. Now, nobody's recommending eugenics here, but as far as planning families goes, don't plan on having 10 kids.
Right.
And that is really, really controversial. People don't want to be told how to make their family, how to organize their families.
Right. Yeah, and I know that some people have said, yeah, it doesn't have to be sort of dictated from on high, we don't need limits and so on. There does seem to be a phenomena that as countries sort of develop and empower women, the birth rate tends to go down mm-hmm. naturally. So for yeah. example, in Canada, we do have a birth rate that's less than replacement, right? So yeah. if we didn't have immigration, our population would actually yeah. be decreasing.
Yeah, immigration would be yeah. good. And I guess there's a whole topic there. We've got climate-based immigration taking place, so climate refugees, people escaping the low-lying islands because, you know, they can't live there more. Miami is regularly flooded now just from high tide.
Yes.
So people can no longer live in those places and need to move somewhere else. And yet the borders we've set up prevent that from happening.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was speaking about with that sort of allusion to justice. Like, how are yeah. we going to think of it as we're all in this together on planet Earth? Or are we going to kind of say, well, we're Canada and we're going to kind of protect ourselves, you know? And what about the fact that we're settlers here? How do we treat Indigenous people?
Yeah. You want to delve into that a little deeper, I think. The Wet'suwet'en crisis or blockades that are happening in British Columbia.
Yeah.
But let's have a listen to some music. I've got something queued up here by Brandon Solomon, who is an Indigenous folk singer. Here's a song that he's written called Reservation Line.
go by, thinking about when I was 10.
Brendan Solomon, that was Brendan Solomon, Indigenous folk singer and reservation line. You have in the studio Katarina Lindman, and you have some information about the blockade in Wet'suwet'en.
There's a potluck at St. Paul's College, and there'll be a showing of a film. There'll be a discussion about the situation, the blockade in Wet'suwet'en. It's unceded territory, and the hereditary chiefs are trying to stop the gas link pipeline, which would transport fuels to the liquid natural gas terminal that's being built in British Columbia.
So you said hereditary chiefs. How is that different from other kinds of chiefs?
Well, there's also an elected band council. The elected band council is in favor of the pipeline by and large. So then there's this debate about, well, who has the actual authority for the Wet'suwet'en territory?
And you said it's unceded territory. Is that being recognized by the government?
Probably not. I think they're looking at the elected band chiefs as being the, in charge of the territory, right?
So all this talk about reconciliation is just talk, really. There's no thought of recognizing First Nations as a separate nation. There's no recognition of the hereditary chiefs, which is the band's own selected form of governance.
Yeah, I would say that's accurate, yes.
That's unfortunate because it's just colonialism writ large.
Yeah. And we're so used to colonialism that sometimes it's hard to see it, right, when we're living right in it.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that having this event taking place is going to make that recognition for people locally at any rate.
Yes.
We don't have a lot of Indigenous presence here, at least not visibly and overt. I mean, there's a lot of Indigenous people living here in Kitchener and Waterloo, but it doesn't get a lot of attention. It doesn't. I see people regularly at the rallies because they've been invited out as the keepers of the land, the protectors of the water. And so if we followed native practices, we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in.
That's right, yes. Yeah, and this Friday, so we're having another Fridays for the Future climate strike. But this one is in support of the Wet'suwet'en cause.
Right.
And it'll be at 12 noon, Friday, January 17th, and it'll be on King Street in front of the museum.
At the corner of King and Queen Street?
Yes.
In Kitchener,
not yes.
Not in Waterloo.
Not in Waterloo.
Like all the other ones have been.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, I'm looking forward to that because I think it's really important to support the Wet'suwet'en people. As well, the museum is putting on a new exhibit called Alarm about the climate crisis. And it opens for a sneak peek on Saturday, January 18th, this coming Saturday.
The day after the rally.
The day after the rally. And on the following Thursday, January 23rd, people that are 55 and over can get in free. And there's an event from 1:30 to 3 o'clock. With Angela Carter. Angela Carter teaches at the University of Waterloo in the Political Science Department. And she studies climate change and the Canadian context of, like, what's the supply and the demand of fossil fuels. And she will speak about hope amidst the climate crisis and what our role is in the Waterloo region. So I think that's really important for people in the Waterloo region to learn about what our role can be in this climate crisis.
And where's that taking place?
And that's taking place at the museum.
At the museum is?
Yes,
okay.
On Thursday, January 23rd at 1:30.
Okay. This exhibit goes for a while?
Yes.
So.
Yeah, it starts in January and then it'll go for a while, yes.
Runs for several weeks, maybe a month or two?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I don't know exactly.
Okay,
but, yeah.
Well, you can look that up, stick it on the website as well. It'll all be on the show notes at radiowaterloo.ca/CCC. Yeah. You're not just involved in climate change. You have other interests as well.
Yeah, I do. I'm an actuary, and I helped found an organization called Actuaries for Sustainable Healthcare. And
actuaries are not healthcare professionals, though.
No, but we do.
So what do actuaries do?
What do actuaries do? Well, we study risk, and we work in insurance companies, and there's some in academia and so on. And risk managers and looking at investments. And we also design pay systems or insurance schemes. So the Actuaries for Sustainable Healthcare is asking actuaries to, first of all, learn about whole food plant-based nutrition.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we're seeing it as a key to a sustainable healthcare system because, for example, if you have a heart attack and you put in a stent, it's kind of like putting a Band-Aid on. It's not really getting at the root cause of heart disease. And the body can heal itself with the proper nutrition.
Right.
So it is possible to reverse heart disease, which is our number one killer, and all sorts of chronic illnesses that take up about 80% of our healthcare costs are preventable and reversible with whole food, yeah, plant-based nutrition.
And so now we're looking at a cultural change again.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I came across it because I thought, well, this is necessary to fight climate change, is to adopt a plant-based diet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as a bonus, it also makes people healthier. So that's, someone can ask, well, what's in it for me if I switch my diet? You know, they might think of it as giving up meat. But after a while, you don't miss meat. Like it's a change. It's not really, it's something new, right? And it involves whole cultural, like, do I want to change? How do I change?
Yes.
But the world around me maybe isn't changing. Do I stick out? You know, and we want to get to the point where it's normal to be plant-based, right?
Things
and
aren't easy if you want to make those changes. I mean, it's look at your average fast food restaurant. I don't think there's any vegan fast food restaurants. You know, there's some sit-down dining spots, Pyrus Cafe downtown here, Fresh Ground, Queen Street Commons. Those are the ones that I know about.
Copper Tree, Uptown.
Oh, Copper Tree, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's another good vegan place. But you have to go looking for those places, you know. You can't just walk down a downtown street.
Right. Now, some fast food chains are coming up with, like, plant-based meat alternatives, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to A&W, you could get, I guess, the Impossible Burger, for example.
It's very, very prominent in their advertising.
Yeah.
And is that really reducing the carbon footprint, or is the production that goes into those plant-based burgers as intense as the meat-based burgers?
They are more environmentally friendly. I wouldn't say that they're actually healthier. So if you want healthier, you'll have to go to whole food plant-based. So go to Fresh Ground, which is a great place. I volunteer there once a week. And it's helped me, like, learn more about cooking and how to cook whole food plant-based at home.
Right.
And I just also like supporting that, and it's like a community experiment. You know, what do you feel like if you eat this way, right? It's a place for people to try the food and enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
They work hard to make it taste delicious.
Yes.
So.
And you know, plant-based foods taste every bit as good as other foods.
Yes.
So I found that I've reduced meat in my diet and largely supplanted that with carbs. So, you know, I don't think it's done me any health benefits, but
well, the thing with carbs, it's a bit of a myth that carbs are bad. It's a half truth, perhaps, because you could say refined carbs are bad.
Okay.
But if they're not refined, if they're like whole and in the natural form, and you get the fiber from them, they're good.
Okay.
So, for example, a rice noodle, they've taken all the fiber out.
Yeah, okay.
And a lot of the nutrition.
I'm thinking bread.
If you ate brown rice or the whole grain,
yes,
that's good for you.
Okay, so more changes are needed to
realize
the health benefits.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's still awkward to do. If I go to a local grocery store, I don't really see a vegan foods section. You know, there's places like Full Circle Foods, which is, you know, all plant-based. I don't think that there's any animal agriculture products there.
Oh, I think they do. I think they have some organic meat and some free range.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, that's I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
But still, that's one place to go for.
Right. Most of it's plant-based, exactly.
Yes. Yeah, I thought they were entirely plant-based, but okay. It's still having to know about these places, you know. It's not necessarily within walking distance of where people live. You know, if you're out in the suburbs, you go out to the local grocery store and
We really have to spend more time in the produce aisle, right? Right.
Shall we listen to some more music?
Yes, thank you.
This is the Soviet Influence and called Secret Spaces. changing world from the inside. That's exactly what we're trying to do. Peter Snow from the Soviet Influence, who are coming into the studio on February the 24th, a local to Waterloo region at any rate. Not sure that they're actually based in Waterloo region, but they'll be coming into the studio just before their release party at the end of February. So looking forward to that on Monday the 24th. We're making change from the inside with Katharina Lindman.
Yes.
You are involved in actuaries for
sustainable healthcare, yes.
Sustainable healthcare. We started off with Rise for Climate.
Right.
And is that a single group or is that an umbrella group of organizations?
The Rise Waterloo region is part of an umbrella group that helps organize the climate strikes. And then we also do our own events. So some of our projects are art projects, and we also are working on a solar furnace project where people can learn about what a solar furnace is and even go to a workshop and build one.
Okay, what is a solar furnace?
A solar furnace is, it's a kind of, you know, maybe it's like 4 by 8 foot panel that collects the sun's rays in the winter and it makes the, it's a box that then traps the heat from the sun. And then you would have two pipes, like through two holes drilled into your wall, because this box is on the outside, usually vertically against
the
house wall where the sun shines. And then there's a little fan that would then bring the warm air in and blow the cold air out.
Okay.
And it can offset maybe 5% of your natural gas use in a house.
Okay.
With so one panel.
That's useful. And it's on the side of the house, not on the roof.
Correct. So yeah, you want it vertical because in the summer the sun is high and in the winter the sun is low. So when it's low in the winter is when you want it to shine in, and so actually doing it vertically is the best way.
And it's not going to get covered in snow that way either.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. A good Canadian climate solution.
Yes.
Yeah. And other groups, Citizens Climate Lobby?
Citizens Climate Lobby, yeah. I've been involved with that group since 2013. And I joined it because I was finding that, okay, I've done what I can as an individual to reduce my carbon footprint, but we really need society to change, and we need effective climate legislation. So the two things that Citizens Climate Lobby focuses on are eliminate fossil fuel subsidies and also to put a rising price on carbon dioxide emissions.
Right.
And then take that money that's collected and give it back to citizens equally or equitably. And the reason we do that is we notice that the people that are richer tend to emit the most carbon. Mm-hmm. Poor people emit less. So it's a way to kind of fight income inequality a little bit, protect the poor people, and by returning all the money to citizens, we're hoping that's more palatable to people who, you know, maybe in the States, which is where this organization started, don't want government to grow, like, because then it's not a sort of a tax and spend
sort of what
thing.
The federal government is doing now, though.
Because of the federal backstop, in Ontario, the Ontario government had cap and trade, which qualified for the carbon price. Firstly, then when it was canceled, they no longer had a price on carbon.
Yeah.
So the federal government has imposed it and is returning the money to citizens through their taxes.
At a useful level? Are the carbon...
No, they're not high enough. One of the criticisms that the conservatives have about the carbon tax is that it's not high enough to do something. And they're absolutely right.
Okay, I didn't realize that was one of their complaints. I just thought they were worried about the out-of-pocket that your average citizen has to endure for this
carbon
tax.
Right, which that argument can be shot down by the fact that it's fully rebated.
Yes. And most people
come out ahead,
come out ahead of that, yeah. And so there's a bit of competition here with you and your neighbor. You know, if your neighbor ends up driving his large SUV, then he's essentially subsidizing your rebate.
Yes, yeah, that's right. So the idea is make that price meaningful, like, and...
I think the current level is like $35 a ton of CO2.
It's going up to $50 in 2020, and it's going up by $10. So I think it's $40 in 2021 and $30 in 2020.
I've heard that. It needed to have started at $50 a ton and go up by about $50 a ton a year to be a truly a disincentive to...
Yeah, we need it way higher. So the Ecofiscal Commission studied it and said, you know, at least $150 to by 2030, and that's to meet our target, which is already too low. So, yeah, I wouldn't mind it, a very aggressive price on carbon. Yeah. And tell people about it, because that way businesses can plan. Like right now, we don't know what's going to happen past 2022. The government said we will increase it, but we don't know how, by how much. And we hope that it comes out as at an aggressive pace, because the scale of the problem is getting quite severe. We need to act. Yeah. We need to model the behavior we want to see around the world.
Yeah. Other ideas to reduce fossil fuel use. You mentioned divest Waterloo. Oh, we're off mic.
Yes. So divest Waterloo is pointing out to people several reasons to divest your assets from fossil fuels. There's the moral argument, right? If if Bill McKibben's famous line, if it's immoral to trash the planet, it's also immoral to profit from trashing the planet.
Yes.
And then on the economic side, you have two forces that are happening, two trends. One is that the capital expenditure for fossil fuel, new fossil fuel projects, is getting higher and higher, right? Because we use the easy to get at fuel first, and then what's left is getting more hard, more risky.
Which is why we're seeing fracking nowadays.
And exactly. And then secondly, the cost of the alternatives is continuing to go down.
Yes.
So battery storage is getting better. There's improved technology to to get more energy out of renewable energy sources.
Big news this weekend was that Scotland has generated enough electricity from wind power to power Scotland twice over. They're producing, you know, 100% surplus over the last few days or weeks or months. So I can't see the excuse of wind power isn't effective any longer.
So perhaps we need to focus more on the positive things and kind of frame this as an opportunity to remake our world in a more just way, in a more clean way, in a more sustainable way. You know, and I see that even with plant-based diets. Like, isn't it better to avoid these diseases, like these chronic diseases of heart disease and diabetes and so on, feel more energetic? Like, those are good things. And perhaps that might be more compelling than, oh, there's going to be this disaster if we don't change our ways.
Yeah, I think there's never an end point when it becomes too late. A lot of people are at the state now where they say, oh, it's too late. You know, nothing we can do about it. We might as well live to the whole hog and you know,
eat, drink, and be merry.
Exactly, exactly. But it's the problem continues to escalate. Costs are going up. I mean, insurance. I had to pay my insurance, you know, for the upcoming year, and it has gone up. They're trying to sell me a new rider for flood insurance, which was never an issue where we lived until about 2 years ago, when Elmira Main Street, you know, flooded with a meter of water from Canagajic Creek, which had unprecedented. That had never happened before. So the insurance companies are recognizing. Well, as an actuary, you understand that. But individual people aren't. I mean, think of this last election. It was the most climate-focused election that I remember in my lifetime of elections.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we did not overwhelmingly elect a climate-conscious government. What's wrong with people?
Maybe people are just caught up in day-to-day survival. And they might feel overwhelmed by climate change, and maybe they do feel hopeless and they don't know what to do, which is, I think, it's incumbent on us to get educated about the things we can do and meet up with like-minded people that want to take this issue seriously and want to act. And then you get sort of hope from one another and support from one another that, yes, this is important.
Don't despair. We have solutions.
Yeah.
And
not that it's going to be easy to change, because change is difficult.
The longer we delay action, the more difficult and more expensive that action becomes.
Yes. Yeah. Back in 2013, I wish we'd had a price on carbon,
exactly.
Or even before that.
And 30 years ago when it was recognized.
Right.
You know, the tragedy is that it's recognized at all levels, including by the oil fossil fuel companies themselves. yet if it interferes with their profits, they're unlikely to take action, something like that. Well,
right. No. And it doesn't have to. Like, they could... It doesn't have to interfere with their profits if they're willing to change their business model and say, we're an energy company, not an oil and gas company.
Yeah.
That's a shift.
It's a huge shift, and I don't think large multinational corporations are equipped to do that easily. It'll be expensive for them to do that.
Right.
Yeah. But if they don't do it, I don't foresee much future.
Right. So, yeah, there's no business on a dead planet. I've seen that slogan on the signs.
Yes, very much so.
Another one is systems change, not climate change, that we do need to change the system. Mm-hmm. So there's that balancing act between individual actions and also demanding a change to our system so that individual actions sort of naturally gravitate to solutions.
Right. So coming out to the movie on, tonight.
Yes.
Tonight at St.
Paul's College. It's at 5 to 7. There'll be a movie screening and a potluck, and you can learn more about the struggle of the Wet'suwet'en people. And then this coming Friday, I'd love to see you at the protest, the climate strike, in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en nation. And, that's where we begin. We have to kind of say no to new pipelines, right? No to pipeline infrastructure. It's uneconomic. It doesn't make sense for the climate, and it doesn't make sense if we're serious about reconciliation with Indigenous peoples.
My social media timeline is full of issues and actions. Local activist Louisette Lantaigne, Lulex Online, just pointed out that there's plans for a pipeline coming up from Pennsylvania full of fracked gas coming to Hamilton. So, you know, pipelines are still being planned, are still being built.
Yes.
So does rallying really help?
I think so. It raises awareness. It sends a signal to the politicians. People care about this issue.
I know politicians have come out to the rallies and spoken and tried to tell us all is well. I don't necessarily agree with those politicians. So do come out to the rally, 12 o'clock, 10 King Street West, in front of the museum.
Yes.
The corner of King Street and Queen Street. And then St. Paul's College tonight for the movie. That's on Westmount Street, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah, something of 150 Westmount, 140 Westmount in that neighborhood there, just north of Conrad Grable, I believe.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, St. Paul's
And that's,
College.
Do you know the room where that's taking place?
No, I don't.
It will be on the website,
yes.
radiowaterloo.ca/CCC.
Yeah, and do we have time to mention on January the 23rd,
please,
Thursday, 1:30, if you're 55 and over, you can get in for free to hear Angela Carter speak about hope in the climate crisis and our response in the Waterloo region.
We certainly need some hope. I've heard Angela speak before. She's been at many other rallies and presentations. Very engaging speaker, very knowledgeable, so worthwhile coming out to that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Let's play another piece of music. I think I have something queued up. Sounds like a movie soundtrack. It's Joseph Martoni from his album called The Honeybirds. This is called The Deal. Not Canadian, not entirely Canadian. Produced in Canada, produced in Montreal. Joseph Martoni.
You know the deal back home, always fall, never alone. There's no time for me to carry on. We got high with the cherished gold. We got down, we were in the cold. But the seeds were scattered on to stone. So we found the way that we would own. Thank you. soup, I'll never be alone. We were soup, I'll never be
Joseph Bartone and The Deal from his Honeybirds album, to be released, I think, a little bit later on, if it's not out already. You've been listening to CKMS Community Connections. My name is Bob Jonkman. We've had a nice chat with Katarina Lindman from Rise for Climate Waterloo Region. CKMS Community Connections is produced by Radio Waterloo, sponsored by Radio Waterloo. Executive producer is Jennifer Strong. Associate producers are Jordan Dorans, Dylan Bravener, and Jeff Steger. My name is Bob Jonkman. Hour 2 of Community Connections airs on Friday at 2 p.m. We'll see you next week, Monday at 11. Our special guest will be Tamara Lawrence with more climate change information. Happy Monday to everybody.
We got down, we were in the cold, but the seas were scattered on to stone. So we found